You can't have prosperity with stolen land. Period.
Which side are you on, boy? Which side are you on, my lord? Which side are you on, boy? Which side are you on?
See, I gotta draw a line, I can't take it no more. If you ain't down with revolution, what you waiting for? Making money for suckers and not communities poor. Ripping flags off of coffers, man, this ain't our war. Colonized and terrorized by the world's biggest killers. The US government, the biggest weapon and drug dealers. Filling prisons with children, incarcerating the future. MySpace and Facebook got us stuck on computers. Stuck on stupid bumping music that's abusive to the shorties. And the nonsense that you spitting, they just listening, absorbing. I've been dormant, I've been working. I'm a giant, I'm ready. I'm with the Apple and Oaxaca, and we hold the machetes.
I rock hard like Palestinian children holding slingshots. I'm with every single kid that's down for hip hop, for the culture, the life, what it really stands for. This music is resistance.
Hey everyone, welcome to the Houston Indie Media News Show. Tonight we're going to be hearing a few different voices. The first is a comrade unpacking white anarchism and white anarchist spaces, and encouraging people of color to create our own radical spaces. After that, we're going to hear from Robin DiAngelo, who is the author of White Fragility, from her YouTube video entitled Why I'm Not Racist is Only Half the Story. And lastly, we will hear from a young high school student explaining colonialism very simply to his teacher.
Oh my gosh. I know that what I'm posting is a bit... What would be the best way to say it? Extreme. But there's a reason why I'm putting something extreme. One of the reasons is that this type of analysis that I've had was really a compounded analysis of what my experience have always been with white anarchist spaces. Right? I think one of the profound experiences that I've had with white anarchist spaces, particularly the relationship of people of color and a predominantly white anarchist people in U.S., is that there's a lot of hypocrisy in the space. Hypocrisy in the context of the relations between people who are born in a position of privilege, who hold leftist ideology, and those people who are marginalized people who hold leftist ideology. There is a lot of polarization between what white anarchists, and when I say white anarchists, white cis people who are descendants of plantation chattels, plantation owners, or the benefactors of colonization and also chattel slavery, right? When I say that, those are the people who has the opportunity to check the box and say, I am white, I am cis, I am U.S. citizen, when they try to go back to their normal life and get these prestige power, prestige resources, give them opportunity to gentrified area. Why do I think this is a problem? Because white anarchist people rarely confront their own form of bigotry. There's a lot of this fantasy about this idea that somehow movements needed to be outsourced from Europe. No disrespect for European comrades, like that's their thing, that they needed to be outsourced from Europe to somehow build a movement, right? Never, or rarely, will white anarchists center black and brown and indigenous people beyond the typical, we're just going to hold the banner because that is the typical thing we have to do, right? There is a lot of anarchist community that are of color that is rooted, I will say, back to Harriet Tubman, the MOVE community, the Black Army. Those exist. Do I think that in anarchist spaces those things exist? No. Because white anarchist people don't feel obligated enough to simply say that they need to climb down to their white horses to simply say, you know what, we're going to hold ourselves accountable to you because you are the most marginalized people in the community, right? If white people find this offensive, maybe you need to turn the mirror around and ask yourself why you're offended by it, because maybe you are fostering some sort of bigot line, right? Because at the end of the day, they are clicking white, they are clicking cis, they are clicking all of these things that is contributing to the very construction of American enterprises, right? Oh, in the United States alone, the way we see anarchism is always written off in the 19th century when white poor people were resisting the form of labor practices in America. We just don't want to acknowledge that black and indigenous people, in particular up and down Americas, have been fighting whiteness and colonialism in the system, in capitalism, that is literally built by white people, right? So to me, that's the thing that is so frustrating, is that, like, I don't believe that white anarchist is the space for marginalized people of color, because I feel like 90% of our labor in these spaces have always trying to empower white people to do better, right? I used to believe that it's possible. I used to believe that I can, I admit, there were many times when I feel like somehow maybe we can find solidarity with white anarchists and acknowledge that within this reality, somehow we need to change the way we engage with each other. For white people to try to get down from their high horse and meet the marginalized people in the community. Guess what? Because at the end of the day, you are looking after for yourself while tokenizing marginalized people to make your own platform, right? You like to co-op movements. You like to take movements away from marginalized people and try to put a white face in front of it so you can somehow feel the fantasy. And that's the reality, right? You like to reposition yourself in a space and claim authority over the experience and the feelings of black and brown and indigenous people, which, by the way, not only experience violence in those spaces, are also experiencing violence outside rally spaces. Right? We should be asking Native and Black communities who are leftists, oh, how do we rewrite the semantics of leftist platforms? Because at the end of the day, if anarchists, white anarchist spaces will not cave into or will not decolonize the way they're doing, waiting for them is the death of our community. Waiting for them to unpack themselves is an incarceration of our community. To be honest to you, why? What is the incentive for white anarchists? What is the incentive for white anarchists to hold themselves accountable to black and brown and indigenous people of any gender when they benefit at the end of the day with checking white, checking cis, checking citizen, and this whole entire system is built to uplift them by default? What is the incentive? And I think people need to start having those conversations and simply saying, like, we're not winning in these spaces. We're not gaining anything from these spaces other than literally putting labor to try to uplift their white European design of anarchism. Because that's pretty much it. So I feel like it's important for us as, like, leftist anarchist people of color to really just be like, we need to create our own spaces away from the white fuckery. Because at the end of the day, I feel like we're not going to able to create something forward, and this is an opportunity for leftists of color, you know, to really come together and simply saying, what is this for us? What is anti-colonial looks like for us? What is anti-capitalism looks like for us? What is this? Because if predominantly people that's working in the fields right now to uplift the capitalism is marginalized of color, and people that are experiencing xenophobia and our Native communities, and we're not getting some sort of resolution or an ideal solution to overcome oppression and repression and whatever the f*** that's happening in the world in the hands of white anarchism, at some point we have to have a conversation within our community and said, what can we do to resolve these issues as a community that had more empathy, that had more beyond just empathy, to try to resolve systems of oppression that is built to uplift them.
Tú nos dices que debemos sentarnos, pero las ideas solo pueden levantarnos, caminar, recorrer, no rendirse ni retroceder, ver, aprender como esponja. absurdo. Nadie sobre todos, faltan todos, suman todos. Para todos, todo para nosotros. Soñamos en grande que se caiga el imperio. Lo gritamos alto, no queda más remedio. Esto no es utopía, es alegre rebeldía del baile de los que sobran de la danza tuya mía. Levantarlos para desollevar. Ni África ni América Latina se suba. Un barro con casco, con lápiz a patear el fiasco. Provocar un social terremoto en este charco. Vamos.
Systems of oppression are highly adaptive, and they can adapt to challenges and incorporate them. They can allow for exceptions. And I think the most effective adaptation of the system of racism to the challenges of the civil rights movement was to reduce a racist to a very simple formula. A racist is an individual, always an individual, not a system, who consciously does not like people based on race, must be conscious, and who intentionally seeks to be mean to them. Individual conscious intent. And if that is my definition of a racist, then your suggestion that anything I've said or done is racist or has a racist impact, I'm going to hear that as you just said I was a bad person. You just put me over there in that category. And most of my bias anyway is unconscious. So I'm not intending, I'm not aware. So now I'm gonna need to defend my moral character. And I will, and we've all seen it. It seems to be virtually impossible based on that definition for the average white person to look deeply at their socialization, to look at the inevitability of internalizing racist biases, developing racist patterns, and having investments in the system of racism, which is pretty comfortable for us and serves us really well. I think that definition of a racist, that either or, what I call the good bad binary, is the root of virtually all white defensiveness on this topic, because it makes it virtually impossible to talk to the average white person about the inevitable absorption of a racist worldview that we get by being literally swimming in racist water. So let me connect that to myself. As a result of being raised as a white person in this society, I have a racist worldview. I have deep racist biases. I have developed racist patterns. And I have investments in the system of racism because it's served me really well. It's comfortable. It's helped me overcome the barriers that I do face. And I also have an investment in not seeing any of that for what it would suggest to me about my identity and what it would require of me, right? I didn't choose any of that. I don't feel guilty about it. It is an inevitable result of being raised in this society in which racism is the bedrock. The question of guilt comes in what am I doing about that? While we who are white tend to be fragile in that it doesn't take much to upset us around race, the impact of our response is not fragile at all. It's a kind of weaponized defensiveness, weaponized hurt feelings, right? And it functions really, really effectively to repel the challenge. You know, as a white person, I move through the world racially comfortable virtually 24/7. It is exceptional for me to be outside of my racial comfort zone. And most of my life, I've been warned not to go outside my racial comfort zone. And so on the rare occasion when I am uncomfortable racially, it's a kind of throwing off of my racial equilibrium. And I need to get back into that. And so I will do whatever it takes to repel the challenge and get back into it. And in that way, I think white fragility functions as a kind of white racial bullying, to be frank. We make it so miserable for people of color to talk to us about our inevitable and often unaware racist patterns that we cannot help develop from being socialized into a culture in which racism is the bedrock and the foundation. We make it so miserable for them to talk to us about it that most of the time they don't. Right? We just have to understand that most people of color that are working or living in primarily white environments take home way more daily slights and hurts and insults than they bother talking to us about. Because their experience is they're going to risk more punishment. They're going to lose the relationship. They're going to have their experience minimized, explained away. They're going to cause the person to feel attacked or hurt. And in that way, white fragility functions as a kind of everyday white racial control. None of that has to be intentional or conscious, but that is how it functions. And it's actually incredibly liberating and transformative to start from the premise that of course I've internalized all of this, and then I can stop defending, deflecting, denying, hoping you won't notice, minimizing, explaining, and I can just let go of that and get to work. And there's a question that's never failed me in my efforts to unpack. How do we pull this off? How do so many of us who are white individually feel so free of racism? And yet we live in a society that is so profoundly separate and unequal by race. And the question that's never failed me is not, is this true or is this false? Is this right or is this wrong? But how does it function? How do these narratives that I tell, how do they function? When I tell you, well, I'm just an individual, why can't we all just be individuals? When I tell you, I was taught to treat everyone the same. When I tell you, but it's focusing on race that divides us. When I tell you, but I have lots of friends of color. Those narratives have not changed our outcome, and they function to take race off the table and to exempt the person from any further engagement. And in doing that, they function to protect the current racial hierarchy and the white position within it. It doesn't have to be what I'm intending to do, but it is the impact of those narratives.
My name is Brian Ridgway. I'm a sophomore at John Marshall High School. I have a very pro-US English teacher, and I wrote this essay for her. Since the US has been founded, they have used the right of discovery to justify the genocide of American Indians and the theft of their land. Put simply, the right of discovery gives the discoverer all rights over the land that has been discovered. So the European settlers that came to the Americas do not have the right of discovery, because the American Indians discovered this land first. Using the Europeans' logic, I could go to England, a place I've never been before, and claim that land, then I would have the right of discovery. America was not a lawless land inhabited by savages. Every tribe of First Nations people had their own laws, had their own cultures, and had their own ways of life. The European settlers thought the natives savage because they respected nature and didn't abuse its resources. Because the natives lived modestly and didn't let greed corrupt them, white people considered them inferior. The reason why more people don't realize this is because in the US, schools are used as brainwashing institutions. From the ages of 4 and 5 years and up, they feed children lies, misleadings, and biased views of American history and current events. I've never read any American history documentations provided by the education system that even use the word genocide when describing what has happened and what is still happening to American Indians, even though that is the only thing I can think to call it. In no documentation of American history provided by the education system does it explain the hundreds of treaties between the US government and the First Nations people. The US government has never once upheld a treaty made with the First Nations people. Even after the Lakota tribe beat the US government in a legitimate war, the US government still failed to abide by the treaty. In schools, the education system makes small children pledge their allegiance to the US government before they are even old enough to understand the words they are saying. Even in high school, students don't bother to think about the words they are saying because it has become routine. In American schools, students are taught that Christopher Columbus discovered the New World. How can someone discover a piece of land that is already inhabited by over 2.1 million people? Christopher Columbus is celebrated and praised in schools because he was the first white person to begin the act of genocide against Native Americans, although the school would never phrase it this way. In school, what they have showed us, but people seem to overlook, is the fact that the US government does not follow their own laws when it inconveniences them. In a Supreme Court case between the Cherokee tribe and the US government prior to the Trail of Tears, the Supreme Court ruled in favor of the Cherokees and said that the government couldn't legally evict them from their lands. However, the president during this time, Andrew Jackson, disregarded the ruling of the Supreme Court and had armed men drag Cherokees out of their homes and force them to walk on foot over 2,200 miles west. On this first journey, over 800,000 American Indians died. The American government did not even offer the natives condolences, compensation, or even an apology. What the American government did give to the natives was more deaths and more land theft. The way the education system presents American history follows the same pattern as every country that denies the atrocities they have committed. First, they deny that the atrocities even occurred. Then they will admit to the atrocities, but claim that they don't matter anymore. To say that the genocide of American Indians does not matter anymore is worse than saying the Holocaust doesn't matter anymore. It's worse than saying 9/11 doesn't matter anymore. Those two events, as important as they are done and over with. But every day that the natives don't have rule over the land that is rightfully theirs is another day added to their oppression. Any support given to the American government by any one person or group of people is assisting that oppression. If everyone realized that this land belongs to the natives and put pressure on the U.S. government, eventually, little by little, we could work to undo the oppression and right the wrongs of our ancestors. White people do not belong on this continent, at least not in the way we exist here now. The numerous atrocities committed by the U.S. government aren't just limited to interactions between the natives. Even modernly, America commits numerous atrocities in many countries, all to feed its greed. The U.S. government seems to want to control the world. Out of all the countries in the world, only 9 have no American military personnel, and the spread of wasteful, greedy, and materialistic ways of American life is evident in many foreign countries.
That's it for our show tonight. You can find links to everything you've heard on our Facebook page, Houston Indie Media Radio, or at kpft.org, or at radio4all.net. This is V, signing off and reminding everyone out there, don't hate the media, be the media.
Surgió. Con la mano de obra barata se construyó esta gran nación. La misma que hoy discrimina, mira a quien se le niega justicia. Ven, te invito, mira la cifra, tú y yo estamos la misma. Sin empleo, te miran feo, pero no creo en el noticiero. El que quiere convencerte que viva la vida con miedo. Del negro, del emigrante, criminales que quieren matarte. Terroristas que están en la lista, cuidado que van a escucharte. Más bien es conquistarte, más fácil explotarte. La muerte o la cárcel, mira el caso de Trayvon Martin.
La patrulla me está vigilando.
Enemigo de la policía, siempre sigo siendo MC Rodrigo de Rebeldías. Y no somos los únicos que siempre tenemos el puño arriba. Somos muchos, miles de millones, los que luchamos por la justicia. Quiero hablar de Romali Graham, shot in front of his brother and Grams. Quiero hablar de John Collado, la policía lo asesinaron. Oscar Grant tomaba el tren, el próximo día se casaba Sean Bell. Hilton Vega, Anthony Rosario, Anthony Valle lo mataron. Amaru Diallo only had a wallet. Trayvon Martin couldn't go to college. Rukia boy, Rukia boy. All I gotta say is Rukia boy. They killed that boy, King Money Great. And all these rappers got nothing to say. Like it's okay that the girls go off, the kids get popped, the cops get off.
La tuya me está vigilando.
Miedo que me puedan parar, mucho menos si razón o motivo que ustedes ni siquiera me pueden a mí explicar. Todo bien entiendo que a casa de crimen cometido para que me hagan cuestionar.
¿Sabe cómo sospechoso?
Pues enseñamos la prueba y el crimen que yo hice, señor oficial. ¿Será por la forma en que me veo, por la forma de mi caminar?
No sé.
¿Será por odio racial o será por nuestra seguridad?
No sé.
Lo único que yo sé y la única cosa que también entiende, lo que ustedes están creando se llama desconfianza y inseguridad en contra de la sociedad. Pero la pregunta más importante es que con esto la delincuencia parará. O siempre apete el número de arrestos sin sentido en la lista de ellos aumentará.